part two of The Function of the Ego, January 17th, 2009, because when they're playing the audio tapes in their car, they can't figure out what the second half belongs to. So, there we go. Hopefully I've settled that for them. So, is there any discussion that you'd like to have about this? And by that I mean that it's not necessarily a question so much as something that you're working with or on that you'd like to share with the group.
I've got something. This is Wendy here.
Wendy.
Hi. Can anyone truly know all of another person? Someone has just brought that up, that they are so overdeveloped that no one can know them all. But, yeah, I'd just like your view on that.
Rather than my giving you a personal opinion, I'm going to reference the guide. So in Lecture 180, which is the spiritual meaning of relationship, the guide, and I'm embarrassed to paraphrase because I don't have a memory for precise wording, but what the guide says is, how could you ever be bored with someone because there is no end to knowing them? So even though in the way you phrased it, it sounds like the person might have been saying it slightly arrogantly, it may still be true.
Yeah, possibly. Mm-hmm.
But it may still be true. That it would, since we do not know ourselves totally, it would naturally follow that we do not know another person totally. And whether somebody says something in arrogance or in truth, it doesn't change the fact that they may be right. But I would challenge that, I would challenge why a spirit would come here who was so highly developed that they didn't need the rest of us. I would be curious about that spiritual journey. That respond a bit to your question?
Yeah, I mean, I said I didn't think anyone ever truly knew anyone.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a, I think that the, I don't think anyone truly knows anyone else, but that you do, that there's an intimacy, that person is probably after an intimacy through knowing, whereas I think they're looking in the wrong direction.
Mm.
No?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But it follows from your thoughts, Jan, that why would somebody be here if it's so life task is to know another without first knowing, you know, him or herself? So it seems that the question begs the follow-up question, which would be, it seems that the life task is to first concern ourselves with ourselves, and in the process of loving, share ourselves with others.
Mm-hmm.
So it's more of a, in terms of a push and pull,
yeah,
it's more of a push process than a pull process.
Mm-hmm. And keeping in mind that every person on the planet is working out distortions. So you can be a very developed being and you're still working out distortions.
And you would be a distraction, like instead of focusing on myself, I need to know somebody else fully. If I, and I don't even know myself fully.
Yes, it can be a distraction. Okay? However, learning another person teaches us about ourselves.
Sure. That's the brotherhood. That's the you know, spiritual principle of brotherhood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there's always a negative version as well as a positive version of everything. There's negativity in love and there's positive in love. Okay, or you can put negativity into love, and you can put positive intention into love. So in the push-pull, in the knowing of another person, you can reach out to another person almost in a codependent manner.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're not able, you have an underdeveloped ego, and you're not able to see yourself. But you can manage to see a bit more deeply when focused on the other person. So the way that's described in the lectures is that's simply where the pendulum is. That you may spend an entire lifetime on one end of a spectrum. Not because that's all there is, and not because it's right or wrong. But that's where you're working. My experience is, I didn't know quite how to phrase that. I have opinions, I have many opinions, but when I work with people, I try to back off and see a larger point of view. And what I see when I pull back is I see more and more people learning many things in a single lifetime compared to the stories that I've been told and that I read about in the literature, in the history, and so forth. And that there may be a quickening, a spiritual quickening on the planet where we do more things in one lifetime than perhaps we used to do. In other words, when you live on a farm and you only know 10 people in your whole life and you spend your whole life out in the field working the farm, I'm not saying you can't be a wise and enlightened person from that, but when you are living a modern life and you've got four or five different professions in a single lifetime and several relationships and you're moving rapidly through various social stages, that you may be interacting more because you have you're in different phases of learning. Does that make sense? Hope it makes sense.
Yes. And it makes sense that the material became easier. If you compare it centuries ago, the material was much, much harder. And so
mm-hmm.
it was easier to spend a whole lifetime entrapped into the material side of things.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was such a struggle.
And
so now you conquer that, and then you go like, well, you know, I did that. Still doesn't feel, you know, I still don't feel happy, so what else is there?
Mm-hmm. So if we take that and we analogize it to a modern life, I know a lot of people who spend 20 years doing something, and then their life speeds up rapidly, and they do 2 years of this and 2 years of that and 2 years of the other. And it's kind of curious, how could I have spent 20 years doing something? And now I move from place to place or job to job every 2 years. Well, there was a learning, a base being built that you're now taking advantage of. That other lifetimes could be, in the positive sense, a base from which we're working, where we needed an entire lifetime to learn a lesson, and we don't need an entire lifetime to review that lesson again. So what I'm offering is this, and several questions in a row have touched in on this. I find it useful as a spiritual practice, when I feel something negative, to find a positive version of it, so that I'm seeing a more rounded picture. So for instance, when the question was asked, if somebody says, I'm so complicated you couldn't possibly understand me, I think, what's the positive of that? Yes. Yes, you are. You are so complicated. You and every other person on the planet. You may be slightly more complicated, but there isn't anybody so uncomplicated that I could know all of who they are. You're simply expressing a range. But there's truth in what you say. So another way of saying that is I try to find the grain of truth in what people tell me, rather than focusing on where they might be in distortion or they might be on one side of a spectrum. Their view from that end of the spectrum could still contain truth. And when I key in to their truth, it helps me to be a part, or to feel like I'm sharing a part of their experience rather than standing off and judging. Does that make sense? So in this discussion of we live perhaps quicker lives than people used to, I try to remove any inclination on my part to make that better than or me good, them bad. Just like I would not judge a three-year-old who needed to spend all day learning how to balance their cup of milk. I wouldn't judge that being as less developed on a spiritual level. That's simply their developmental phase. I was there, but I'm not there now. And that being will move along rapidly or slowly, depending on their needs. And I may not want to spend my entire day or week with a three-year-old. That may not be what I want to do. Rather than judge them, to simply notice that I'm in a different developmental phase. I think I kind of went off on a tangent there, but maybe not.
That's good. Thanks, Jan. It's Wendy again. If anyone else hasn't got a question, I've got another thing that came up for me, and that you said that an overactive ego prevents deep, profound meditation, mm-hmm. but to some extent the male active principle, if a male has more active principle in them, meditation isn't going to work as well for them as for a female. So what's the best alternative to meditation for a male?
Well, I'm going to tease you about that, because the saying is that Gandhi couldn't relax and meditate.
Oh, okay.
So I don't think that the fact that men tend to specialize or focus more of their life energy in the active principle as meaning that they cannot meditate. But I also, and this is again, it's my personal spiritual practice of saying, where have I decided, and I'm going to take your statement, I'm going to take it and express it in an I statement from myself. Okay, so I'm not judging you, but it's easier for me to communicate if I say it from I.
Yep.
Why do I think that meditation in this format is superior to meditation in that format? So the question itself may carry an assumption. Okay? Number one, that person's task is to learn to meditate when it may not be their task. So a person who is infused with the active principle, as if on a spiritual level they've got ADHD, that whatever that acronym is for attention deficiency syndrome, okay. A spirit may get born on the planet with that kind of hyperactive, you know, inability to relax. But if you go back far enough, the question would be, why? Why did that spirit choose that degree of active energy? And the only answer that I can come up with from a spiritual perspective is they needed it. Either they needed it to find something, or they needed to learn to conquer it. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So you speak of a man has more of the active principle. That may be true, but that doesn't mean a man can't relax. It may mean that a man's task on this planet may have less to do with meditation than with manifesting. Okay? That may be true, but for an individual man in an individual circumstance, it is difficult to judge what is appropriate for them in their development. And what I'm trying to build here, and it's a little clumsy, I hope it makes sense, what I'm trying to suggest here is that when you say generically, you can say males have more of the active principle, and women have more of the receptive principle. But on an individual basis and level, that's not true 24/7. That everyone has a variety of active and receptive. So I'm curious, if you're willing, without necessarily being personal, and certainly without you know, bringing somebody else in who might not appreciate it. Can you flesh out a little bit more about what your question might be about?
Okay, it was just that in conversation with a male, he actually said that it's a feminine thing to meditate. It doesn't work for males. Males have a different way of relating to their higher self. But he didn't actually explain to me in the details that I could understand how a male works in relationship with the higher self.
Okay, I'd like
to give you. Is that enough?
Yeah, I'd like to give you an example. I personally do not meditate, and I felt guilty about this. You can imagine I'm in this spiritual practice, and I'm doing years and years and years of work, and I'm doing helpership, and everybody's talking about meditation, and I'm feeling guilty as sin because I never sit and meditate. That's not what I do. And then one day I realized that there was an activity. In fact, there are several activities that I do where I'm going to call it zoning out. I don't mean falling asleep. I don't mean going unconscious. But there are several activities that I do where my mind becomes free. And I began to notice. I began to notice that when I'm doing many, many things, sometimes that, oddly enough, allows me to release my mind and go into a thought process. Now, this is one of them. It's a minor example. But for some of us, we meditate when we're driving. If we have a regular long commute where your ego takes over the moment-to-moment, turn left, turn right, put on the brakes, and you go into an automatic driving mode, it's a very common experience to arrive at your destination and not remember specifically, moment by moment, how you got there, especially if you've gone on that route many, many times. What if this is another form of meditation? So what I'm suggesting is that what he says may be true. It may also be a defense. I have no way of knowing.
It seems that it's just a defense, because if you look historically, all the hermits, you know, the traditionally the monks, the gurus, the people who go off on a path of detachment from the material world and go off in isolation to live a life of meditation, sometimes prayer and meditation, these have been quintessentially male figures. I mean, Buddha was a male. So just looking in history, the figure of female meditators is quite recent. I mean, unless you became like a nun, but then it was more related to prayer, really, and service than really meditation. So I think history doesn't even, I think he was just looking for a defense, because history doesn't even seem to support that. There's an interesting article by Ken Wilber about that, about how actually it's the other way around, about the traditional meditation path. It was designed for males, and how maybe for women it needs to be a little different, because women need to be a little bit more engaged in the world. So it's interesting how he makes exactly the opposite argument than your friend was making.
Mm-hmm. That's very interesting. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Women meditate when they knit?
Yes.
Is it possible that women have simply learned to accommodate the needs of the real world in a way where they can zone out quietly with their minds and yet accomplish something? So I'm agreeing with your talking about men may go off and do it for a living, but women may do it day in and day out.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm suggesting is, rather than judge that, to notice that there are differences. And those differences can add up to the place where you say men follow the active principle in acting to go off and do it as a profession. And women may be receptive in the place where they acquiesce to the needs of their family, and they don't go off and meditate, but they find little places where they can meditate quietly during the day. So I'm inviting a deeper understanding of the cliches.
Thanks, that's actually what I wanted. I wanted to have another, get some other views on it.
Mm-hmm. Are there any other thoughts or contributions that anyone would like to make?
Jen, I have a question. Since we're on the topic of meditation, do you, in your experience, do you have any sort of meditation that you found particularly helpful? Like, it seems that guided meditation wouldn't be very helpful for this kind of work.
There's a very famous meditation in the lectures. There's three lectures on meditation. But the one that's interesting, and it's interesting because people can wrestle with it a little bit. You don't have to just zone out and hope that you reach God. In this particular moment, my mind's gone blank. It's either 182 or 183. And it is nicknamed the Three Voices. Okay? And when it's taught, what we use is we use three chairs. And the meditation the lecture suggests that there is a way of meditating where you sit on one chair, or even if you have a long couch, you can have different places on the couch, and you just kind of have to know that this end is this voice, and that end is that voice, and the middle is the middle voice. But that you gain an appreciation for the different voices that are coming into your consciousness, and give them a container and a space, and listen to them. That this is a form of meditation. So like I said, the nickname is called Meditation for Three Voices. It invites you to hear, for instance, you can listen to any three voices you want, but the lecture specifically talks about listening to the destructive child and the adult ego and the real self. And to hear that you have conflicting points of view in you, but to allow space for those points of view to be heard. And what the guide is suggesting is that is a form of meditation, because after all, what is meditation except trying to access the divine, right? And aren't we divine? And if we are divine, is not our destructive, egotistical child divine? As well as our adult ego? So that by listening to the different voices inside yourself, you can become more attuned to the core of your real self. So that is a form of meditation proposed by the guide that is very, very active. It's a little bouncy. So sometimes when I teach higher self, lower self, and mask, I do the same thing. It's kind of fun if you take a red cushion for the lower self and a gold cushion for the higher self and so forth. But there's a place of sitting in that energy and trying to access and speak from that voice that brings up things you may not have heard before on a conscious level. It's useful. So patchwork meditation is not Buddhist meditation. And by that I'm not in any way trying to diminish it, but it's not sitting on a cushion and zoning out. And the Buddhists have walking meditation. And many, many other spiritual practices have ways of meditating where you do engage the motor system of the body. And it's useful to do so because then you have less to think about. So if I go on for a second, that's what I mean by depending on your personality and your situation, your circumstances, you may be doing more meditating than you realize when you are driving a car. That by utilizing your conscious ego functions and keeping them busy, you may actually have a capacity to hear and talk to your real self. Does that make sense? So I'd like to suggest that you read the Meditation for Three Voices. It says Meditation 182 or 183. And see what you think about that. And see if by listening to these voices, you might find a different way of being with yourself and accessing your divine nature, which is, again, the purpose of meditation. And the method by which you do that can be entirely personal. For some people, riding a bike, when you're riding 50 miles on a bike, you're not totally conscious of every single second of that journey. So there's a lot of time when your body may be, where your mind, your ego mind, may be very, very busy keeping balance, watching the road, checking for traffic, watching for stones in the road, permitting a part of you to be quiet and peaceful. And long walks can be the same way. And so the pathwork meditations tend to be somewhat active. Pathwork meditation tends to be more about accessing voices within you than about stillness.
I found it, Jen. It's lecture 182.
Okay, thank you very much. I'm embarrassed sometimes when I... At least I came close. Sometimes I'm...
You were very close. You were very close. Impressive.
Well, when you're 70 lectures off, it's embarrassing, but only one, I can appreciate that. Anyone else want to contribute something? Well, I'm learning that an hour and a half is really a good time period for these presentations and discussions. So, we'll go ahead and let this go. Thank you very much for participating. I enjoy them very much. I hope you do. The next one I'm going to do is going to be on lecture 248, which is, I don't know why I can't seem to get the title right. It's not the three principles of evil. It's the personification of evil on three principles. I'm probably not even saying it right then, but it's an interesting lecture, and I'm fascinated by it. So I don't think it's glum or negative in any way. It's a fascinating, different way of looking at negativity. So I hope you join me then. And thank you very much for participating. I very much appreciate it.
Thank you.
And
no worries.
Thank you, Jan.
Okay.
Thanks,
bye-bye.
Jan.